Welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's politics podcast. Britain has voted to leave the European Union, the Prime Minister has resigned, and this weekend it's far from clear if anybody is actually running the country. I'm Fraser Nelson, and I'm joined by my colleagues Isabel Hardman and James Forsyth to work out what, if anything, is going on. And we're delighted also to be joined by Marcus Roberts, a former Labour strategist, now with the pollster YouGov. Isabel, we know politics has been thrown up in the air. Is there any sign of anything starting to fall back down?
Well, it has gone rather oddly quiet, hasn't it? We haven't heard anything from George Osborne, who's presumably still hiding in the Treasury. And the people we probably really want to hear from are the people who've just campaigned to take us out of the European Union on what should happen next. And the problem for them is that they all have different views on what should happen next and on what sort of Brexit we should end up with. And that's the real challenge for the Leave campaigners now, is that they were united around one cause, which was Brexit. But now they don't really know what Brexit is. It's like saying, I want cake, but not necessarily agreeing on whether it should be coffee cake or fridge cake or Victoria sponge. And an almighty row over that sort of cake is going to ensue.
James, was there such a thing as a Brexit manifesto?
The nearest they came to a Brexit manifesto was they published six parliamentary bills that they would like to see before 2020. I think part of the problem, as Isabel said, is that until we get a Tory leader, until we get a prime minister, we don't know what kind of Brexit Britain is going to pursue. And one of the reasons we don't... So there are two reasons we don't know. One is we don't know what the British government is going to ask for. And the other is we don't know what the rest of the European Union is going to agree to. At the moment, there is complete confusion about both because the current British Prime Minister has resigned and we're waiting for a new one to be appointed.
So, Marcus, we're going to get a change of government. Normally, when this happens, we elect a new one and it has a manifesto. This time, the new Prime Minister is going to be chosen by the remaining members of the Conservative Party who comprise, 0.03% of the electorate. Isn't this a rather strange situation for British politics, in fact, any country's democratic politics to be in?
Absolutely. And what we have here, let's be generous to the Conservative Party and say that there are indeed 150,000 members and that there will be 100,000 of them voting. That means that 51,000 Conservative Party members will choose the Prime Minister of Britain and as a consequence set the constitutional, foreign policy, domestic and economic agenda of this nation, not just for the rest of this parliament, but for generations to come. And that is an incredible responsibility. And because of that responsibility, what you are seeing in the Conservative Party right now is something similar to what you're seeing in the Labour Party right now. Brexit has unleashed all of the internal political forces that have led them to have a leadership crisis. Whilst the two mainstream parties are doing this, however, power is lying unclaimed in the streets. But power never lies unclaimed for long. Enter the nationalists. That is why you have seen Nigel Farage as the face of Brexit. That is why you have seen Nicola Sturgeon in Scotland and Sinn Féin in Northern Ireland move to exploit this for their own purposes, because the mainstream parties are so concerned with their internal politics.
So, Isabel, everybody in Westminster knows that something has got to be done, except it doesn't seem that any party in the House of Commons knows who is supposed to do it.
Yeah, and I think this is a worry for everyone in Westminster, really, is what happens if you don't get your act together and what happens if you don't address some of the concerns that voters have voiced in this referendum. I think Monday is going to be a very confusing day in Westminster, actually, because MPs will be coming back for the first time after this referendum, really, for the first time for a few weeks, because don't forget they only returned for a very brief recall to pay tribute to Joe Cox. So they're going to be sort of milling around. I think it's defence questions at 2:30, which is going to feel like a bit of a sort of sideshow to whatever comes afterwards, a statement perhaps presumably from the Prime Minister, at which point people will be saying, well, what happens next? And we don't even know really how Cameron's going to answer that or who's going to answer that for him.
Marcus, there are 229 Labour MPs, of which about 10, maximum 15, supported Brexit. So this isn't simply a question of Jeremy Corbyn not being connected to Labour Party voters. This is about 95% of Labour MPs seeing Britain in a fundamentally different way as a majority of their voters, let alone the party members.
The Labour Party, without question, faces an existential crisis from this. And unless the Labour Party across England and Wales wants to go the way of the Scottish Labour Party, it needs to react strongly and fast to this. Why? Because Labour voters and the Labour Party are now more out of sync with each other than ever before. Roughly 35% of Labour 2015 voters backed Brexit. This was in the face of Remain from Neil Kinnock, Tony Blair, Gordon Brown, Ed Miliband, and even, ostensibly, Jeremy Corbyn. The reason for this was immigration. And yet, today's press conference by Jeremy Corbyn, we still saw a pro-immigration, pro-internationalist message from the Labour Party. Unless they get the Labour Party understands that its internationalism can no longer trump its economics, then the Labour Party can't be surprised if these voters go somewhere else. And that matters because UKIP is the number one challenger to Labour in 44 Labour seats.
But James, Britain's just voted to leave the European Union. What happens to UKIP now? They were a single-issue party. Britain has left. What does Nigel Farage do now? He's won. He can go and retire, can't he?
Well, I think that UKIP will keep going on one thing, which is, as you say, there's a disagreement about what kind of Brexit we should have. So I suspect they will continue to fight for a slightly different kind of Brexit. But it's an interesting argument that was put to me by one of the people who will vote for Boris Johnson in the Tory leadership contest. He said, look, UKIP got 4.6, I think I'm right in saying 4.6 million votes at the last election.
Yeah.
Make a Brexiteer, e.g. Boris, Tory leader, and you probably get half of those moving into the Tory column. Meanwhile, you let UKIP go after Labour in the kind of ex-mining seats that the Tory party is never going to win. And UKIP turns into what we call in Westminster Red Kip. It becomes a party of social protection that wants to spend a lot more money on the NHS, that basically will oppose, for example, trade deals are going to become a big part of British politics. In this person's imagination, UKIP becomes a party that is opposed to free trade, becomes a kind of protectionist party designed to appeal to a particular kind of voter who we might call a nationalist in other countries.
But Isabel, if that were to happen, UKIP would need to make a very quick change from an anti-EU party into a new party of the working class. Now, Nicola Sturgeon and Alex Salmond managed this very effectively in Scotland, but do you get the sense that Nigel Farage can manage this? Or is it the case that under Farage they can't? They would need to pass leadership to somebody like Suzanne Evans, or they would need to show that they can mutate and organise like a normal political party rather than the creation of Farage himself.
It strikes me that UKIP has got one of its best opportunities ever, but is in the worst position to take it. It is so disorganised and so riven with internal factions. I mean, Farage, during the referendum campaign, called Douglas Carswell, the party's only MP, irrelevant, and he's barely speaking to most of his party colleagues. And he seemed to be, as you said on previous podcasts, Fraser, in a sort of deliberate sabotage campaign during the referendum designed to draw attention to himself. So it is a struggle for UKIP to do as well as it could do, were it a sort of SNP-style, slick, organised force. But it does have a big opportunity now, and if the party manages somehow to organise itself, it can really do extremely well in those Labour seats.
Marcus, you said that Labour's facing an existential crisis. So which party is better placed to exploit that crisis, UKIP or the Conservatives?
I think that the scenario James outlined from his anonymous Conservative Party source is a very real and very dangerous one for the Labour Party.
The Boris scenario. Boris comes over and goes after you and Labour.
Yes, but what with Red Kip going after Labour in Northern Heartlands. In order to counter this, the Labour Party is going to have to move on things like leadership, move on things like immigration, and also move out of the mourning phase for the loss of the European Union and into the acceptance phase of Britain's new independent destiny. The party can do that, then maybe the party has a chance. But it's going to have to show a kind of alacrity of both intellect and political speed that it has previously struggled with.
Marcus, can I just ask you a quick question? I was very struck by the divide in the Labour Party. You look at Andy Burnham, the Shadow Home Secretary, who's in charge of immigration policy nationally. His constituency voted very heavily for out. Obviously, though, Jeremy Corbyn comes from Islington North, a constituency which is much more pro-immigration. Now that immigration has been chucked back into domestic politics for the first time in quite a while, what kind of immigration policy do you think Labour will